If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
As I'm sure you already know, this podcast is produced by the team behind BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. And if you haven't had a chance to get hold of our magazine recently, we'd like to offer you the chance to get a copy of our next issue absolutely free. Please text the word HISTORY to 78070 to request your free magazine today. One of our team will be in touch to organise delivery direct to your door. This offer is available for a limited time only and only available for UK residents. So please don't miss out. Text HISTORY to 78070 to get your free copy today. Just a quick note, texts are normally charged at your standard network rate. Please check with your provider for further details.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Rob Attar, the magazine's editor. Today we continue our podcast series counting down the top five of history's greatest mysteries, which you voted for in our online poll. In fourth place on the list is Why Did the Roanoke Colony Vanish into Thin Air? That was nominated by the historian Malcolm Gaskill, who was unfortunately unable to speak to us for this episode. So instead, we caught up with Misha Ewan, a historian of the early modern Atlantic world based at the University of Manchester. Joining her to discuss the mysterious fate of this 16th century English colony was our world history editor, Matt Elton.
Could you very briefly outline what the mystery is that we're talking about in this interview?
So the mystery of Roanoke and the lost colonists refers to a settlement of 118 men, women and children that was established in what is today North Carolina in 1587. The mystery is about the fact that when leaders of the settlement returned in 1519 to resupply the colonists, they had entirely disappeared. And since then, historians have been trying to figure out what might have happened to these people, whether they were killed or whether they might have assimilated with local Native American populations.
What was the sort of political situation in both America and England at the time that this was happening?
So at this time in North America, there are no permanent European colonies established at this time. But in the Caribbean and in South America, Spain has a vast empire in Mexico and Peru. So the English really are trying to establish their own foothold in the Americas through the establishment of this colony at Roanoke. And the background to this is ongoing rivalry between Protestant England and Catholic Spain. Elizabeth has been on the throne for about 30 years, so she's really at the height of her power. But increasingly, tension between England and Spain is mounting. And in 1588, Spain actually attempts to invade England with the Spanish Armada. So this is what's going on in the background at this time. So increasingly, it seems urgent to English Protestants that they should also have permanent settlements in North America in order to challenge Spanish imperial dominance in the region, in order to convert Native Americans to Protestantism, in order to supply England with the natural riches and resources that they hope they're going to find in North America.
And how does this colony fit into the history of colonies in America?
So at this time, the English have no permanent settlements in North America, but they have been to the region. So they first go in 1584 to explore this area around North Carolina where the Roanoke settlement is established. For several decades as well, the English have been fishing in the waters around Newfoundland in Canada for cod. So they are familiar with the region, but they haven't yet actually managed to establish any permanent settlements. But of course, there are Spanish settlements nearby in the Caribbean. And it's essentially from the eastern coast of North America that the English imagine that they might be able to take advantage of their position by attacking Spanish shipping in the Caribbean and generate wealth through privateering and piracy. It would potentially be significant from that point of view in terms of, you know, tactics in being able to try and rival Spain in that region, essentially.
And who was selected to go on this expedition?
So the first expedition in 1585 is made up of around 600 men. And in the end, about 108 individuals remain in Roanoke. They're led by an individual named Ralph Lane, but amongst them, it's a variety of artisans, so people like coopers and shoemakers and carpenters, but also metallurgists who are going to test ore samples there and look for precious metals. But amongst their number are two individuals who become very significant in early English colonial enterprise, John White and Thomas Harriot. So John White was an artist who essentially produces some of the first images, English images that we have of Native Americans in North America. And Thomas Harriot is a scientist and mathematician, and they both on their return to England are very important in promoting English colonisation to the public more broadly. They write texts and these images circulate widely, and essentially it's the first sort of propaganda that the English have for colonisation in North America. This first expedition is men only, but when they return in 1587, the focus then is establishing a more civilian settlement. And amongst the number then are women and children as well. So the kind of character of the settlement changes over that period.
And what was life like in this new world that they'd arrived in?
So when the English arrive, one of the first things that they try to do is try to establish relations with the local Native American population. And they do this with mixed success. So they are trying to establish trade in things like animal skins. And some of that is friendly and they exchange gifts and objects. But there are also skirmishes that break out with some of the local groups. And this sometimes erupts into quite violent encounters. But essentially what they're trying to do is establish whether colonisation is going to be economically profitable So they don't spend too much of their time, you know, trying to grow crops and things like that. Instead, they're looking, searching for kind of mineral wealth, these mines that they've heard of that, you know, they'll be able to extract gold and silver from. But a lot of this, obviously, these encounters involves trying to learn more about the land and the people that inhabit it and the language. And one of the things that they do is take captives back to England with them. So in 1584, two individuals called Manteo and Wanchese are taken by the settlers and brought back to England. And Thomas Harriot lives with them, tries to learn their language, and he actually creates an Algonquian dictionary. So I guess we have this impression of the English of trying to learn more about the people and the land and the culture and language that they've encountered in the New World.
And what did they make of the native people, and vice versa? What do the native people make of them? Do we know?
So the people that inhabited this part of the eastern seaboard were familiar with Europeans to some extent, you know, passing sailors and people who were exploring this part of the country. So when the English arrived, it wasn't entirely unexpected. They had some familiarity with European encounters, and they knew to expect that maybe that there would be trade relations. But increasingly, the Native Americans begin to see the English as a threat to their way of life, and they're encroaching increasingly on their land. And this does lead to violent conflict. In 1585, they kill the leader of the Sakowaton. Their chief is named Wingina, and they actually behead him. And I think we need to understand that it's a complex relationship, that the English are very much trying to extract something from the Native American population, but that's not always being met with cooperation.
Something else I had no idea about was the extent to which people travel backwards and forwards from England to America. So I think a couple of years later, someone travels back to England because things are going badly. Is that right?
That's correct. So the first settlement in 1585 is around 100 men, and they return the same year with Sir Francis Drake back to England to try and gather more supplies with the intention of returning. The second settlement in 1587 that is made up of men, women and children, again, the same thing happens, that the leaders return to England to try and gather more supplies, but they're prevented from returning to Roanoke due to bad weather, but also a stay of shipping in England because of conflict with Spain and the Spanish Armada. So I guess it was never intended that, you know, people would go and never leave. They would constantly have to come back for new supplies, because at this time they don't have the ability to, you know, make all of the food and clothes and everything that they're going to need to, you know, keep people going. So they would be very much reliant on these sort of new supplies being brought from England. But because of, you know, all these reasons to do with conflict and climate, it's not always possible.
And it's when they return that the mystery starts to unfold, isn't it?
So in 1590, John White attempts to return to Roanoke to go and resupply the settlers that had been left there in 1587. But for several years, he's been prevented from doing that. In Roanoke is his daughter, Eleanor, and his granddaughter as well, Virginia Dare. So for him, this is not just kind of political, it's also very personal. But when they arrive, they find that the settlers have completely vanished, but there are some clues that have been left behind. Apparently, before he left, John White instructed them that if they ever had to leave, that they should leave a clue behind for them, you know, carve a name into a tree of where they had gone. And White finds that on one of the trees, they have carved the letters C-R-O. And this refers to the Croatan people. So he starts to guess that maybe that's where they've gone. They've gone to seek shelter. One of the reasons that they might have gone to seek shelter with the Croatan people is that one of the English allies, Manteo, was actually from that area. So there was already kind of good relations between the English and the native inhabitants there. What White also remarks upon, though, is the fact that they did not carve a cross into the tree. And he had instructed them that if they ever had to leave under sort of urgent circumstances that a cross should be used to show that they were in distress, and there's no sign of that. So he assumes that actually they left, they weren't under distress, and that maybe they've gone and simply assimilated with the Native American population.
I mean, that's so interesting, because the idea of finding sort of a half-carved message in a tree is almost stereotypically enigmatic. Like, I can see why that's led to so much speculation. Were there any other clues at all about what had happened?
So White, in his later narrative that was published in 1600, he says that he'd found that, yeah, they had buried some of their chests with some of their belongings, and that books had been left scattered behind. So he knows that some of their belongings have been left, but at that stage, there's still no further clues about what might have happened to the settlers. But when settlers returned to this region sort of a generation later in the early 1600s, the colonists at Jamestown, which is about 100 miles north, they report that they've heard from some of their Native American allies that there are English settlers who had survived. And they try and go and search for them. They send out search parties in 1608 and again in 1609, but they find no sign of these supposed English survivors. But again, you can kind of imagine that these rumours do circulate that they might have survived and that they have assimilated with Native American communities and continued to thrive in that area.
So one of the theories is that these colonists survived and started new lives with the indigenous people.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's actually this part of the story is one of the reasons that it has continued to intrigue historians so much, because obviously, you know, this is one of the first attempts to establish a permanent English settlement in North America. And although it wasn't successful, you know, within a generation, they have succeeded and we have Jamestown and later the Plymouth Colony. So the fact that we have this earlier story, and there are two things about Roanoke that I think are very sort of interesting and, you know, probably the reasons why it has been mythologized so much in American culture. One is that Virginia Dare, who is born in Roanoke, she's the daughter of Eleanor, who is in turn the daughter of John White. She's the first English child to be born in North America. I think it's given rise to lots of ideas about the origins of white American identity. And over time, unfortunately, this kind of story of Roanoke has been sort of used by white supremacists to, you know, harken back to an origin story of whiteness in America. And this assimilation with Native American communities has been sort of twisted sometimes by scholars over centuries who have said that, you know, there's no way that these white English settlers would have assimilated with sort of Native Americans, especially in the 20th and early 21st centuries. This story of Roanoke gained a lot more traction. I think it was at a time when increasingly white Americans were feeling fearful of immigration to the country and asking questions about, you know, whether immigrants and Native Americans should have rights. And Virginia Dare became this sort of symbol of whiteness in America. I think that's one reason why historians have continued to be interested in Roanoke, to try and unpick some of that complexity about American identity and culture and, you know, where it stems from. But I think also, I guess it's a good story as well, this idea that, you know, and for historians who have, you know, different kinds of, you know, motivations, who are interested in early colonization and cross-cultural encounters, it's really fascinating to, you know, think of what it might have meant for those colonists to have gone and been embraced by a Native American community and assimilated, and what the mixing of those two cultures might have looked like.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
But I do think it's interesting to ask questions about why it continues to interest archaeologists and historians so much. We want to think more critically about myths of the origins of America and American exceptionalism.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
I'm fascinated by the way in which America still, to some extent, sort of harkens back to these foundational myths, and which they inform subsequent ways in which it sees itself as a country. So do you think that this had lasting power in America in a way that perhaps we don't quite understand in Britain?
I think certainly. And another way that we see this as well is in the way that the Jamestown colony has been remembered. So Jamestown was settled in 1607, and as I mentioned, John Smith, who's one of the early governors, does try to go out and seek the lost colonists of Roanoke. He sends out these search parties for them. But Jamestown is also sometimes buried within the American origin story because it's seen as being a failed colony. There's starvation, there's cannibalism, there's famine. So it's seen as being a disaster rather than a success story. But then in 1620, the Plymouth colonists arrive, you know, the Pilgrims, the Mayflower, and that is often seen as being the founding origin story of America. So it's interesting to think about the ways that Jamestown, and even earlier than that, Roanoke, fits into this sort of longer sort of trajectory of the foundation of English North America. I think it has a lot to do with the way that these settlements have been pitched against each other as perceived failures and successes. But ultimately, Roanoke was influential for the settlements that came later in terms of mapping out that part of North America. Mm. You know, it was the first time that the name Virginia was coined for that region. And although ultimately it failed and the colonists dispersed and disappeared, it did at least give English settlers some sense of what it might look like to try and establish a colony there. And some of those, you know, some of that survived in terms of, you know, how they thought about building forts and the manner in which, you know, forts and settlements would be physically established, but also an understanding that you could not have a successful permanent settlement with men alone, that it would be important to send women and children, and also that it would also be essential to try to establish good relations with the local Native American population. But as you can imagine, time and again, they do make the same mistakes, that, you know, sometimes relations with the local population breaks down. And often this is because of things like, you know, pressure on Native American food supplies because the English fail to, you know, harvest their own crops.
What was the reaction to the disappearance when these colonists returned to England?
There's not too much in terms of, you know, what is written down reactions to Roanoke at the time, but we do know that it's something that John White for the rest of his life agonizes about, because obviously he's left behind his daughter and his granddaughter. So for him, it's an incredibly personal loss. But what we do see is that at the turn of the century, as interest in colonization in Virginia is starting to increase again, and, you know, in 1606, the Virginia Company is chartered, and in 1607, Jamestown is established, that there are references to Roanoke in the sort of wider cultural landscape. So there's a play called Eastward Ho, which is performed for the first time in 1605. And in there, they kind of make jokes about these lost colonists who are said to now be living amongst the native population. So although that's a good 20 years later, the fact that it appears in this play tells us that it probably has been there in the sort of English psyche, you know, over the preceding couple of decades, that it's something that people more widely know about and have talked about. And of course, by then, there have been other publications such as Richard Hakluyt's Principal Voyages, which is published in 1600, and that includes John White's account of settlement in Roanoke. So these things are happening at the turn of the century, where I think there's an increased wider cultural interest in attempting to establish colonies again in the New World. So it's something that people are aware of in those circles, and it's having, yeah, an impact on culture more broadly.
Were there any other theories about what had happened other than the fact they had started these new lives?
I guess a kind of grimmer theory was just that, you know, they hadn't survived and hadn't assimilated.
Has there been any subsequent archaeological discoveries or new evidence as to what might have happened?
Yeah, so I guess the first real breakthrough in the search for the lost colonists and the Roanoke settlement came in the 1990s, when archaeologists discovered the site of the workshop of the metallurgist, who was a German metallurgist, where he'd been conducting his experiments. And they found things there like crucibles and jars that had been used in his scientific experiments as well. So that was a major breakthrough, because this evidence very much, you know, located the site to the late 16th century, and they could confidently identify that this was Roanoke based on the written evidence we have as well, that we know that metallurgists went with the settlers in 1585. But one of the next major breakthroughs was in 2012, when one of John White's maps in the British Museum was looked at again, and conservationists there actually found that under a flap of paper on the map, they revealed that there was a star shape that might have referred to another settlement where the colonists might have gone after leaving Roanoke. And this site is in Hatteras Island. And since 2012, archaeologists have been excavating there for material. And they have found Elizabethan and 17th century artefacts. It's not clear, however, whether these are things that would have belonged to the Roanoke colonists themselves, or things that might have been, you know, brought later by English settlers in the mid-17th century, or things that might have been passed down. So there is continuing interest in trying to excavate sites in the area, but so far there's no definitive evidence of what happened to the settlers, or indeed where the Roanoke site itself might have been. But one way to contextualise this archaeological work is to think about the Jamestown settlement. And for a long time, archaeologists thought that that had been lost, that, you know, because of erosion and, you know, hurricanes, that perhaps they would never find the original site of the Jamestown colony. But actually in the 1990s, that was also discovered. So there is still hope that Roanoke, that where the settlement was, you know, could still be found. So archaeologists do continue today to try and look for it.
What would your take be on what happened? Do you subscribe to the theory that these people survived, or do you think it's the bleaker alternative?
I think I believe that some of them might have survived. I think as well, we do perhaps need to give some credence to reports from the 17th century, where these colonists do say that they had spoken to Native American allies who report that they have seen English settlers or the descendants of English people who reported to have fair coloured hair and grey eyes. And much later, in around 1700, there's an individual who also goes to the region, and he speaks to people from Hatteras Island, and he talks about, they make claims themselves that they are descended from English colonists. So these stories have obviously been passed down through Native American oral histories as well. And I think if we're going to take those oral histories seriously, then it is possible that some of the colonists did survive and did assimilate. So, yeah, I'm kind of optimistic that that perhaps is the case. But I guess when thinking about Roanoke and its history, I find it interesting. I wonder whether the question shouldn't be so much, you know, did they survive, but why is it that we're still so interested, and why is it so important in American history and culture? And I think actually that's where some of the really sort of interesting, complex scholarship, you know.
Those are two excellent questions. I'm going to shamelessly steal them from you. What do you think this episode tells us about the wider history of the time and America more generally?
So I think in terms of what it tells us about English colonial history at the time, I think it really brings attention to the fact that, you know, the birth of an English empire was never inevitable, and it wasn't something that seemed inevitable to people at the time. There were these false starts, there were a series of failures. So whilst now we look back on, you know, the history of the British Empire and before that, the English Empire, which did begin and have its origins in North America, to people at the time, there was no guarantee of success. And these ventures were incredibly risky. So I think it reminds us as historians to be, you know, skeptical about thinking about, you know, the inevitability of the rise of English imperial power. Because, you know, at the time, English, compared to its Catholic, Spanish, Portuguese rivals, was incredibly inferior on the global stage. You know, they had no colonial settlements, and Roanoke was really the first attempt at that, but yeah, it was a catastrophic failure. In terms of what it means for our understanding of American history, I think it brings out interesting questions, as we've discussed, about the origins of white American identity. The birth of Virginia Dare is still remembered as this significant event, but I think it draws attention away from the fact that there was already, you know, communities of people living in North America at this time. And I sometimes wonder if by focusing so much on what happened to the lost colonists, that we forget to talk about the impact that English colonization had on Native American populations and people, the consequences of which they're still suffering from today as well. And it is still of critical importance to debates that are going on in America about the recognition of certain Native American tribes. So I'm kind of skeptical, I guess, about focusing too much on the myths of Roanoke. But I do think it's interesting to ask questions about why it continues to interest archaeologists and historians so much. But I imagine that some of that is because we want to think more critically about myths of the origins of America and American exceptionalism, and also colonization as well.
Finally, then, I suppose on that note, how would you like people to make sense of this specific mystery in terms of its actual importance to sort of wider history, I suppose?
So I think understanding the history of Roanoke is really important in order to understand the wider context of English colonization in the late 16th and early 17th centuries, and understand, you know, some of the ways that English colonists are learning lessons, and sometimes the ways in which they're not learning lessons from this very early attempt at colonization. And I think actually looking at Roanoke can help us understand a lot more about the wider European imperial context at this time as well. You know, why was this particular site chosen? Who were the individuals who were involved? And by picking apart some of those questions, we can begin to understand a bit more about the religious and political climate at the time, and also what European understandings of colonization were, but that emphasis was often on commercial gains and why North America was seen as being this place that would offer such riches to European imperial powers.
That was Misha Ewan. You can read Malcolm Gaskill's original nomination, as well as all 19 others, on our website at historyextra.com/greatest-mystery. And that's about it for today. This episode was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll return tomorrow when we'll be revealing what came in third in our poll of history's greatest mysteries.